Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. I mean, so many things. There's daily articles, there's academy courses, there's videos, there's preaching helps. And of course, there's events. And our next event that we're having is in Bentonville, Arkansas. And you can do that in the spring, May 5th and 6th. You can come hang out with a bunch of 1517 folks. We're going to be going over Paul's letter to the Galatians. I mean, that's the theme. The theme of the conference is we're going to go over the whole thing. So this is a conference Bible study. It's going to be a great time. And we got the Arcadian Wild coming up from Nashville to do a concert. The food's always great. And if you've never been, you should come. And, of course, the National Conference is sold out. So this is your chance to come to a 1517 event this year. Your only chance if you're not registered for the national event. So come on down. There's a link in the show notes. And spend your spring in the Ozarks with, Chad and myself. Chad, we ended last episode and we've wrapped up chapter 19. We're heading into chapter 20. Jesus showed up and, killed like 185,000 people or something like that. And King had to go home with his tail between his legs. Or maybe he said, I've got some other stuff to do. I think I'm going to go and take care of that with the amount of arrogance on this guy. But either way, God had said there wasn't going to be an arrow shot, and there was not. And that king went home, and some time passed, and there he was worshiping his false god, and his two sons decided they had enough of his reign. And so they killed him. And that's how the chapter ended. And so we ended with an assassination, but we're going to start circling back around now and see what Hezekiah is up to in sort of the aftermath and wake of Jesus showing up and delivering him from his enemies.
I don't think I mentioned this in the last episode, but if you read the Assyrian Chronicles about this particular episode, I mean, in the Assyrian Chronicles, they record this this coming up against the city of Jerusalem, but they never mentioned that it was, they never claimed that it was conquered. So he says there's a famous phrase in the Assyrian Chronicles about how he penned Hezekiah in like a bird in a cage. That's the famous line from that Assyrian Chronicle. But he doesn't go on to say, and then I conquered the city and I killed Hezekiah, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't even like claim to have done that, which of course is the Assyrians' way of saving face. Yeah. They're not going to say, yeah, I pinned him like a bird in a cage. And then all of a sudden, God came along and slew a huge portion of my army and I had to run away home. Because of course, that's not the kind of thing that you record in Assyrian Chronicles. You only record these great accomplishments of the kings. But that, of course, is at least a slight hint as to the Assyrians, at least acknowledgement they weren't able to actually conquer the city.
Yeah, that's not how that propaganda usually ends. It's usually be something, I pinned him like a bird in a cage, and then I devoted its land to destruction. The women wept in the streets. The earth was salted. It would just go on and on with all of this incredible stuff. And then I lost no one. And the people of the Hebrews lost a million people, and we put no one soldier into earth or some nonsense like this is usually how that goes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so if you complain about propaganda today, wherever you might see it, that's not anything new. No. You've always had propaganda out there. I mean, it's literally chiseled into stone in the ancient world. So if you're reading about the Assyrian annals of what happened or the Egyptian chronicles of what happened, this propaganda is not just on your phone screen. It's chiseled into stone. And of course, it's these outlandish claims, all of which, of course, are designed to make the ruler appear as if he's invincible. Well, anyway, he was obviously not. And now getting into chapter 20, we're going to hear about another ruler, about King Hezekiah again. But here it's not going to be the city that's in danger, but Hezekiah himself, he's going to become sick. Now, do I have to say a word about the opening phrase here? So 2 Kings 20 begins by saying, in those days, Hezekiah became sick. Now, that is a little bit ambiguous. Like, what days? I mean, exactly are we talking about, like when the Assyrian invasion was going on, or the threat against them, or what happened? Now, because of what's going to happen, because of what's coming up, so Hezekiah's going to get sick. He's going to pray. Isaiah's going to say, "You're going to get better." And then, right after all this, you're going to have some envoys from Babylon show up, not Assyria, but Babylon show up. And Hezekiah is going to take him through basically all of his treasuries and show him, you know, how wealthy he is. And then they're going to go home. Oh, because of the fact that Hezekiah is showing them all this stuff, all these riches. Some people say that this section of 2 Kings actually chronologically precedes a lot of the stuff that we've been hearing about the last episode or so. Because if you remember early on, what did Hezekiah have to do? He had to pay a huge tribute to the Assyrian king.
Yeah, dude. I was gonna say that either you got accumulated a lot more stuff in a hurry, or as I remember, like the hinges of the doors were coming off if they had any, if they
Yeah,
were
like
worth
this is
anything.
right. This was a pretty serious stripping of anything worth value in order to pay off the Assyrians. So yeah, if you're reading through this chronologically, you're thinking, wait, how did he come into all these treasures? I thought he got rid of all this stuff. Well, keep in mind that sometimes in the scriptures, things are out of sequence, and they're out of sequence on purpose. So it wasn't like, you know, they accidentally did this. Like they wrote about everything happening with Sennacherib, and they're like, oh man, we meant to include this stuff about Hezekiah getting sick. Well, we'll just put it here. No, this was carefully designed, probably in order that what happens to Hezekiah and his recovery, and then this talk about Babylon, is not only going to be presented as a narrative, a true narrative about what happened, but also it has a symbolic value to where, for instance, Hezekiah's sickness parallels the city sickness. Hezekiah's recovery parallels the city's recovery. And the Assyrians' defeat is then paralleled by the introduction of these Babylonian guys who show up, which itself is a forward glance to eventually what's going to happen when Babylon actually destroys the city. So probably that's why it's positioned here. And just one more thing about how this is structured, which I think is pretty cool. So I mentioned a couple of times how what we're reading in 2 Kings is paralleled almost verbatim by Isaiah. So Isaiah describes these same events. So Isaiah describes them in the last few chapters leading up to chapter 40. So it's like 36 through 39, something like that. Yeah, 36 through 39 is where Isaiah includes this. Now, this pretty cool way that the book is set up, because so after you hear about these events in Isaiah 39, the very next chapter, Isaiah 40, is where you have that comfort, comfort my people. You know, say to her that her warfare is ended, she's going to receive from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And there's this talk about the coming of John the Baptist. And so the way that Isaiah sets this up is he describes Hezekiah, and then he transitions to talking about the true son of David, the Messiah who was to come, which is suggested by the fact that Isaiah describes Hezekiah, a great king, but then immediately follows him by talking about the coming true son of David, who's going to be much superior to anything that Hezekiah could have dreamed of being. So even in Isaiah, you kind of see the same suggestive structure going on. But anyway, in those days, whenever it happened, I'm guessing either during or possibly even before the Assyrians invaded, Hezekiah gets sick.
I think that sometimes it's easy to read the and you should read it this way to a certain degree, but you as you're reading something like First Second Kings, First Second Samuel, different, you know, Genesis, Exodus, whatever, you're reading sort of a historical narrative. You have to remember that we don't believe that the main point of this is to tell you some things that happened so that you know your history. This actually speaks sort of to the inspiration of scripture that you're reading a story, but you're also reading a story within a story, which is the bigger story. It's the reason the story is being told. If this is just some chroniclers like laying down some stuff, yeah, it's probably just going to be chronological, and they're just going to give you and it's going to give you the facts and this kind of stuff. But there's a thread throughout this story that is the main point. And so that means that as you're telling that story while telling a history, you're going to put things together and weave the narrative to best tell that story. And I think that that's what happens a lot in instances. I just say, why is this placed here? Seems out of place. Well, it is out of place if you just want a chronological retelling of historical events. But that's not what the scripture is ultimately aiming at. And so sometimes that through line through the story really pops out to do things like this.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great way to explain it. It's a great reminder, too, that when we're reading through these so-called histories, they are what are traditionally known as part of the prophets. Mm-hmm. So at least in the threefold Hebrew reckoning of the old, what we call the Old Testament, the main part is the Nevi'im, which is the prophetic writings, which isn't just Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, but also Samuel and Kings, because these are understood to be prophetic histories. And by prophetic histories, I mean exactly what you just described. This, they're not interested in just giving you a sequence of events. This happened, then that happened, then this guy came along, and then that guy came along. No, these are all stories embedded within the capital T story that you were describing. It's a story of salvation. So, of course, you're going to have, you know, only certain things told, and they're going to be told a certain sort of way, and they're going to be structured in a certain sort of way in order to lead us along this bigger story of what is coming. So Hezekiah is sick. He doesn't just have, common cold or the flu. He's very sick. We know we're going to find out in just a minute that part of this was connected to a boil that he had on his skin. I'm not told exactly more than that. But anyway, he's sick, and he's seriously sick. He's at the point of death. So Isaiah goes to see him. You know, preacher comes along and to pay him a visit here. Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came to him. And he has a word from God. He says, thus says the Lord. This is not the kind of prophetic message you want to hear. He says, set your house in order, for you shall die. You shall not recover.
Yeah, that's rough. I mean, just you don't want the prophet showing up and be like, all right, you got that will filled out or no? Because you're going to need that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not an encouraging prophetic word. But it is. I love the way the story is told, though, because It demonstrates that God can say something's going to happen, in this case, something not good, at least not good for Hezekiah for sure. And yet it's not as if this threat is unchangeable. So many times God will issue a threat against, for instance, a city or a country. And if they repent, well, then the threat is lifted, right? Well, here you have this, set your house in order because you're going to die. You're not going to recover, you know. Seemingly ironclad speech of what's going to happen, no escaping it. But what Hezekiah does next is pray, and when he does, even though in my opinion it's a terrible prayer.
Oh, I was about to say I actually
awful prayer.
I really like this passage because this is so what you are prone to do.
Yes, but, it is. It's...
But I like. But I think the corrective in it is in God's response, because it's almost like he disregards what Hezekiah probably thinks is the most important part of this prayer, and is the majority of this prayer. It seems that God just disregards that part altogether.
It is. So if you're ever like looking for a great example of somebody like just praying a terrible prayer, and yet God answering it for the right reasons, well then just. Don't even hesitate. Turn directly to 2 Kings chapter 20, and you will have it there. So
this is so the way that we pray when we are panicked and we're trying, we forget who we're dealing with. You have this idea of God, and God is sovereign, and God can do stuff, and maybe he's the only one that can do anything about this, but you forget like the most important thing about him, and it's not that he's like sovereign and powerful and all this stuff. You forget that he's a God of mercy and grace, and you end up appealing to some stuff that you would appeal to another person or a God who wasn't those things.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So here's what he does. Here's what he says. So after the prophet gives him this negative word, you're going to die. Hezekiah turned his face to the wall, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. But he turns his face to the wall, and here's what he prays. It's a pretty short prayer. Now, O Lord, please remember how I have walked before you in faithfulness and with a whole heart and have done what is good in your sight. And then he cried.
You know what I think the best part of this this prayer is? I think this is the part that God answers right here. He answers the weeping bitterly.
I was going to say, he doesn't answer the prayers, but he answers the tears.
The weeping bitterly. But what you want to pray, Hezekiah should just end it right here. Now, O Lord, please remember. That's how you just end right there. Just remember me. Yeah. Don't go into your stuff. Because when you ask God to remember, you're asking him to act. So you just say, don't forget me, God. And that's probably way better.
Yeah, like somebody once said, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Yeah. Yes.
So that's a good prayer. Remember me.
I want God
but
to
instead,
remember me. I don't want him to remember any of my stuff that I've done.
Yeah, I don't remember what I did.
I actually take great comfort in the fact that he says he's forgotten all that. I do wish that for him to remember just me as his child, that I am yours. Remember that fact. You can forget the rest of it.
Yeah, or remember what you've done for me. Please remember that you baptized me into your name. Remember that you have forgiven them. All that's fine. But if you're going to like adopt a prayer to pray from the Bible, please. Please do not adopt this one.
Chad's getting sick. He says, Lord, remember all the videos that I've made.
Lord, remember how many episodes of 40 Minutes of the Old Testament that I've recorded in your name and for your glory.
Don't do that.
No. So please, Lord, forget everything that I've ever done. And remember who you are and everything that you've done for me.
Yeah,
I'm not going to talk about how I've just walked before you faithfully, God, and like all my heart was in this, and I've done so many good things in your eyes. No, please, just don't even go there.
Yeah.
So he wept bitterly, as it's translated here. It's literally he wept with great weeping, which wept bitterly. Good. He cried a lot of tears, and those tears were far better. Far more eloquent a prayer than anything that he actually verbalized. So this he did this right away. So the prophet shows up, says, you're going to die. Hezekiah is like, as it were, rolls over, faces the wall in his bed. Probably he prays, oh God, do this because I've been such a great guy. Then he cries. Isaiah had just gone a little ways from there. Isaiah had gone out of the middle court. So he's just walking away, basically. And the word of the Lord came to him and says, hey, go back, turn back and say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David, your father, adds that in there, David, your father, I've heard your prayer. I've seen your tears. I almost want to add in there, I've heard your prayer, but more importantly, I've seen your tears. I mean, it's not in there, but that's kind of the implication I get. I heard that just terrible prayer that you just prayed. I did hear that, but I've also seen your tears.
Unfortunately, I heard that prayer. But fortunately for you, I also saw those tears.
Yes. Behold, I will heal you on the third day. Oh, there's an important phrase for you. On the third day, you shall go up to the house of the Lord, and I'm going to add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city. Now, this is the language you've heard before. I will defend the city. Why? For my own sake and for my servant David's sake. Same language we heard in the last chapter.
That feels like a subtle rebuke for, like, remember that I'm good and I'm faithful and I'm awesome.
Yes. He doesn't say, I will defend this city. I'm going to heal you. Because you've been such a great guy.
No,
you've been so faithful and follow me with your whole heart.
God doesn't tell Isaiah, hey, Isaiah, tell him he made some good points, and I'm going to add 15 years to his life because, you know what? I felt like I heard the argument, and I agree.
Yeah, I mean, he scratched my back, so I'll scratch his. He did so many great things for me, so I'm gonna give him 15 years to his credit, just because he's been such a faithful, wholehearted follower of mine. No, he says, for my own sake, and for the sake of my servant David, which we discussed in the last episode, is in reference back to God's promise to David to keep a dynastic figure from David's line on the throne.
By the way, it drives me crazy because I see this happen a lot, and every time I see it, it drives me nuts. Because this kind of stuff happens a lot, right? So we've talked about, like, what's the most famous sinner in the Bible? Jeroboam. So the sin of Jeroboam is the sin. This poor guy is just, you know, infamous sinner. And all the time, you'll hear God doing things for the sake of his name or for his own sake and for the sake of his servant David. And this will be taken as some sort of, I'm not going to do it for you and how awesome you are. I'm going to do it because of how much I love David and how awesome he was. Just please, when you read, and for the sake of my servant David or for my servant David's sake, what you need to read that is, I will do it for my own sake and for the sake of the promise I made to, doesn't matter that it's David. Like, it was David. It could have been anybody. But yes. The person is irrelevant. It's when he says for the sake of David, it's for the sake of the words he spoke to David.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nothing. If you're a longtime listener to this podcast, you know about David's life. You know that, yeah, I mean, he started out great, but he ended terribly. I mean, most of the material about David is not good. I mean, from the moment of the whole Bathsheba Uriah stuff, I mean, it just, like, one thing after another. And even before that, David was pretty full of himself multiple times. So it's not as if, for the sake of my righteous, holy, faithful, obedient David. No, for the sake of my servant means the promise that I gave to him.
Yeah, and look, I mean, people, I've actually read people say, like, we're too hard on David. It's a correction. It's a corrective endeavor that we're doing here. Like, David is not by any stretch of the imagination in the bottom half of the kings of Israel. This is not the case. That's not what anyone's suggesting. But what we are saying is David is the most famous and the one that comes up a lot, and you shouldn't think that this is because David was somehow so righteous and so good that God just never got over it. You know, God's just like, I just never got over how great David was. It's not that. The greatness of David is really wrapped up in this one thing, is that he wasn't an idolater, and that when God made him a promise, he believed it. That's what it is. That if you want to know, like, what the greatness of David is, it's those two things. He didn't dabble in idolatry, and he believed God when God spoke.
And all you have to do is read the first and second Kings to realize that's the case. Because as we've seen over and over and over, what do most of the kings do? They don't believe his promises, and they engage in idolatry. Yep. They're not like David, right, as a comparison will often be made. That is what this all boils down to. It's all First Commandment kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a corrective. Maybe we've stressed a lot of the weaknesses and failings of David, but that's on purpose.
Yeah,
it's because, you know, what's her name? Anyway, the southern author were she talks about how to the blind you draw large and startling images, and to the deaf you shout. Well, it's the same kind of idea. You know, you want to accent the fact that David has multiple problems, because very often what you hear is a falsehood concerning him, as if he's just like this obedient and wonderful guy that didn't have any failings. No, besides Uriah. No, there were multiple narratives that document his failures.
Yeah, and I've heard people say that we did sort of do the opposite with Saul, and that we, you know, kind of pick Saul up off the ground and dust him off and say, hey, it's not as bad as you think. And that's a corrective as well, because that is the foil where you have a Saul bad guy, David good guy, and neither of them are righteous. That's the whole point. But Saul is also not uniquely bad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes you stress the opposite of what is kind of the typically the popularly considered kind of estimation of these two kings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So having said all that, verse 7, Isaiah gets practical. He's like, hey, you got to boil. You got to do something about that. So bring a cake of figs and let them take it and lay it on the boil that he may recover. So Dr. Isaiah is prescribing a cake of figs. Nobody knows exactly why that was the case, but that's what they wanted to do. Now, it is significant, though, that we're told that this is, as it's translated here by the ESV, a boil, shechin in Hebrew, because that word occurs a lot of times in Leviticus 13 in connection with that whole broader discussion of quote-unquote leprosy, the skin disease. So that Hebrew word occurs there because there's a whole, you know, you have to diagnose what the problem is, and you have to have a quarantine and have all this stuff going on. Well, the reason that's important in the narrative that follows is because Hezekiah has not been able to go up to the temple. Why? Because the temple was a holy place. And if he had this boil, this skin problem, then he would not have been able to enter into the courts of the Lord. So that's why he's about to ask what he's about to ask with regard to when he should be able to go up to the temple, because this was a kind of defilement of the skin, which would have precluded him from entering into the courts of the Lord. So he has the boil. Isaiah says, put this cake of figs on it. Hezekiah then goes on to say to Isaiah in verse 8, what shall be the sign that the Lord will heal me, that I shall go up to the house of the Lord on the third day? So how do I know that it's going to be okay for me to enter? How do I know that I'm going to be ritually pure, in other words, so that I can once more enter into holy space? And Isaiah says this, this shall be the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he has promised. Shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or go back 10 steps? And Hezekiah responds, well, it's easy for the shadow to lengthen 10 steps, so let the shadow go back 10 steps. And then Isaiah called to the Lord, and he brought the shadow back 10 steps by which it had gone down on the steps of Ahaz. So what's going on here? Well, this is probably in reference to a sundial. We know from both some iconography in Egypt as well as from some text that they had sundials in ancient Egypt that were set up to where as the shadow would move along steps. So we think of sundials as kind of just a flat circular kind of thing, you know, with a little projection. And, you know, of course, the shade is going to fall on certain parts of this circle during the day. But they had all kinds of sundials in the ancient world, and some of these were set up with steps. So as the day got, as the day went farther and farther towards sunset, well, then the shadows on these sundials, sun steps, if you will, would lengthen. It would go farther and farther down these steps. So that's why Hezekiah says, well, it's easy for the shadow to lengthen 10 steps. That's what happens as the sun goes down. The shadow gets longer. He says, what we need then, if this is to be a true sign, is to let it go back 10 steps. Kind of like the sun is moving from, you know, going from the west to the east. And that's what happened. It went back 10 steps, and this was this divine sign that was given to Hezekiah. So I love the fact, by the way, that this happens on the third day. I kind of hinted at that earlier, because this is a pretty common occurrence that we have really from Genesis 22, the whole Abraham Isaac sacrifice scene onward, where when the third day is referred to, it's very often a day where something big happens, or God does something big for his people, or God works deliverance for his people, something along those lines. And here you have on the third day, Hezekiah being able to enter into the presence of the Lord. So all of this third day language is behind what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, that Christ was raised from the dead on the third day in accordance with the Old Testament, in accordance with the scriptures. He doesn't quote a particular passage. He doesn't say, you know, as it was spoken in the prophet Hosea or something. He just says, according to the scriptures. That's why this pattern of God doing something big on the third day is significant, because that is the background of why Christ was raised on the third day.
Yeah, that part's really cool. As you might wonder, yeah, where does it say that Christ is going to be raised on the third day? And the answer is everywhere. That's where it says. That's what Paul says.
Yeah, just pick your text. Yeah. So on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw Mount Moriah.
Yeah.
On the third day, the Lord descended on Mount Sinai. On the third day, Queen Esther appeared before the king to plead the case of the Israelites. On the third day, King Hezekiah is able to go up to the temple of the Lord. So over and over, yeah, it's the third day that God picks out as the day when something like this happens. So the proof text is Genesis to Malachi. That's
yeah.
pretty much the proof text for that. Okay, so after he recovers, we have the following story. This is verses 12 and following. So at that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent envoys with letters and a present to Hezekiah, because he had heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah welcomed them, and he showed them all his treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious oil, his armory, everything that was found in his storehouses. So this Babylonian king that we know from other sources as well, he was kind of a thorn in the side of the Assyrians, from what I've read. He would rebel, and then the Assyrians would come in and try and stomp him out, and he would escape to the swamps. He would like show up again. He'd be a thorn in the side of the Assyrians. They'd attack again. He'd escape to the swamps again. So this is why the Assyrians are still top dog. They're still the international world power. That will change because the Babylonians will replace them, but they're still in charge now. And so this Babylonian king is, as it were, trying to get some independence and rebel against the Assyrians. And so he's a pain to them, and he's probably wanting to, as it were, recruit the Israelites to be on his side. You know, all kinds of confederacies were formed in the ancient world to rebel against whoever the superpower might be. Israel tried to do that with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians trying to do it with others. And probably here the Babylonians are trying to bring the Israelites onto their team so that they can together mount an attack against the Assyrians.
Yeah, and I talked about this, you know, last episode. This is exactly the sort of stuff the Assyrians don't like.
Yeah, it's like this is the way to bring the Assyrian hammer down on your head pretty quickly.
Yeah, they don't like this. And this text also tells you this. Hezekiah is at least somewhat buddies with this king, or at least trust him, because if you got a Babylon is more powerful. I mean, they might not be Assyria at this point, more powerful than Judah, though. And mm-hmm. you come in and be like, let me show you all my stuff.
Yeah, let me open my safe. I'm gonna bring out all my jewels. Here's my gun case. Yeah, look at this. Look at all these guns I have. And yeah, it's a bit. The whole thing seems just a bit naive to me.
Yeah,
on the part of Hezekiah. Well, maybe naive as well as like, oh, look how important I am. And all these, look, the Babylonian king, he sent these envoys to me. You know, the one who walked before the Lord with a whole heart and faithful to him.
It is weird. I mean, you must really trust this guy. Or, you know, and if he is kind of recruiting, maybe you're, you know, he's going there sending the envoy, and he's like, man, we really, you know, I'll tell you what, I mean, Assyria is just getting, you know, those Assyrians, they're just getting out of control, man. And we should definitely be, you know, be of one mind about this. And, you know, maybe Hezekiah's like, oh, yeah, well, let me show you what I have to offer. I mean, look at all this. I mean, here's what I bring to the table, this little alliance that maybe we form.
Yeah, which if our chronology is correct and this happened before the Assyrian invasion, it kind of also gives a reason why the Assyrians reacted the way they did, you know, when they had to strip all the gold from the hinges and whatnot. Maybe the Assyrian king caught wind of this and he's like, oh, you showed the Babylonians all your treasures? Well, I tell you what I'm going to do with those treasures. Hand them over.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah. This is more of a, I heard you showed the Babylonians all my treasures.
Yeah. Accent on the pronoun. So he's showing them everything, you know. Everything, even down to the spices. I got some good spices here. I got some oil. Check out all my weapons, my armory. I got all this stuff. In fact, we're told there was nothing in his house or in all his realm that Hezekiah did not show them. I mean, he's just opening every door, pulling out every drawer, showing them all this stuff. Then Isaiah, the prophet, came to Hezekiah and said to him, and you have to wonder, like, Isaiah already knows the answer to this question. He's like the teacher who asked the question, he already knows the answer to. King, what do these men say? And where'd they come from? And Hezekiah, he still doesn't really catch the drift of this. I'm thinking, oh, they came from like a long way off. It's a far country. It's called Babylon. And Isaiah says, basically, what did you show them? What have they seen in your house?
Hezekiah's and like Hezekiah's every coin and every bullet.
It's like, I showed him all the things. He says, he's still, it's sort of, this is still sort of kind of naive. He's, oh yeah, everything. They've seen all that's in my house. But nothing, nothing in my storehouses that I didn't show them. And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that's in your house and that which your fathers have stored up to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So that didn't work. That didn't turn out very well. This whole showing them all of his things and opening up everything to them. Isaiah says, well, all these things that you show them are not going to stay with you. In fact, everything your father stored up to this day, everything in your house, all of this eventually is going to become nothing more than loot in the hands of the Babylonian army. Nothing shall be left. And I mean, that, of course, that's terrible enough. But also this idea of your sons, like any accents, like those who came from you, the ones you will father, your sons, they're going to be taken away. Not only are they going to be taken away, but they're going to be castrated. They're going to be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon.
And by the way, Hezekiah, you know, broadly considered a top five king. What happens next is going to tell you that he got rid of the high places and then he does some nice stuff. But like, is this a good guy?
Yeah, I know. This whole chapter, you start out with Hezekiah with like, oh man, what an awesome guy. And he is. I mean, again, we're not detracting from the great things he did. He did wonderful things. I mean, very, as far as kings go, yeah, he's at the top. But he's not perfect. He's not divine, right? We saw his prayer. It's very self-centered. Now, imagine you're Hezekiah. You've just heard this terrible pronouncement.
Yeah, where's the weeping bitterly on the heels of this pronouncement?
Yeah. I mean, at least he could have said, oh, that's awful. I'm so sorry. It's terrible news. Here's what he says. I'm just quoting the Bible here. This is Hezekiah saying to Isaiah, the word of the Lord that you have spoken is good. What? How could that be good? Because here's what he thought. And again, we're just telling you right here what the scriptures say. Because here's what he thought. Why not? If there's going to be peace and security in my days. I don't even know what to say to that. That's terrible.
Your sons are all going to become eunuchs. And you're like, well, sounds like that's going to happen. I know I got 15 years left, so sounds like I'm going to be all right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the simul justus et peccator, the simultaneously justified and sinned. This is definitely the sinner part coming out in Hezekiah. The one who's, of course, concerned about himself.
Yeah,
at the very least, he could have said, the word of the Lord you have spoken is bad, you know, or that's not good. But it's like, no, that's good, because at least it's going to be okay for me.
Yeah, all these threats that I'm worried about and stuff, apparently I'm not going to have to deal with them.
Peace and security in my days, that's all that matters. Well, that's Hezekiah. He's a sinner saint. And the rest, you want to know about more Hezekiah? Well, you know where to turn. The rest of the deeds of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and, now this is an ominous note here, Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. Now, we'll get to Manasseh in the next episode, but what we will see is a definite switch from father to son. And by the way, this pool, this conduit that brings water into the city, well, you can still see that. Visit Jerusalem today. You can go to Hezekiah's tunnel, where they started at opposite ends and dug this tunnel, met in the middle. Actually, scratched, inscribed a sign there in the tunnel, which documented how they did that in the days of Hezekiah to bring water into the city in case the city went into a siege from the Assyrians. But anyway, that's Hezekiah. Good guy, great king. Not so great a guy, not so great a king. I mean, he's a motley mixture of the two, right? He's a sinner and a saint.
Yeah. Well, that is it, man. That is chapter 20. We will be back next episode to get into the boy King Manasseh, only going to be 12 years old when he begins to reign, and we'll see how that goes. But you have to wait until next episode for that. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.